This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
The F Word, Vancouver's explicitly feminist radio show, filling your head with naughty feminist ideas since 2007.
This is The F Word, a feminist syndicated show produced in Vancouver, BC, Canada, at CFRO 102.7 FM, Vancouver's cooperative radio station. Every Monday from noon to 1, we broadcast live from the downtown east side of Vancouver, unceded Coast Salish territory. And my name is Ellie Gordon-Marshall. So the Archives of Lesbian Oral Testimony was founded in 2010, and they digitize and make available online lesbian oral testimonies. Their address is alotarchives.org, and on their website, one of the things they state is that lesbians have been excluded from the official historical record, but their experiences tell a great deal about the past. They reveal what it meant for a woman to desire and love other women and to survive and resist against a culture that treated them as sinful and deviant. Their stories open a window onto a world that once was and help us imagine a world that might yet be. So on today's show, we're going to be airing an interview I did very recently with the director of archives, Elise Chenier, and she is also an associate director at Simon Fraser University. Before we delve into that interview, we'll start off by playing a segment of one of the archives that the website has. And this is just a short clip by a woman named Ivy, and she's talking about her first time going to a lesbian bar.
He said, would you like to come over to a local bar where I go? And I said, well, I don't drink. Oh, well, that's okay. She said, I'll have a quick beer and you can have a Coke. I said, okay. So she walks me along Dundas Street and, like, my mouth must have been dragged and I was in awe. Okay, because I never went along Dundas Street through Chinatown. I didn't even know that stuff existed. Okay, I lived out here. This was the boonies, the east end of the city. Yeah. Okay. Well, she took me into this place. Oh, it was called, oh God, I had the name on the tip of my tongue. It was on Center Avenue, anyways. A little quiet place. And I walked in, I see all these guys sitting there, and she went in to talk to them. So this one guy comes out and he says to me, are you with Rocky? And I said, oh no, 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 I says, I'm with Joan. Who the fuck's Joan? I went, pardon. A girl, I was ready to run. I wish I could remember that place.
It was it mostly men?
It was dykes. It was butch broads.
Oh, it was all butches.
Yeah.
So that was Ivy talking about her first experience there. And that was in Toronto, if you didn't catch where she was talking about. So we're going to hear some more from her and another woman, but from the archive. But before we do that, we're going to hear an interview I recently did with Elise Chenier. So she's the director of the Archives of Lesbian Oral Testimony, which you can find at alotarchives.org.
Why don't you start off by telling me, just telling me about yourself and how you came into working on lesbian history?
All right, well, when I was an undergraduate at York University doing my BA, I took a Canadian women's history class, and one of the things we had to do, our major research paper, was to do an oral history. So I interviewed an elderly woman who was really fascinating. She actually had been a nurse in World War I, and she had a really interesting life story to tell, and I really got turned on to that oral history as a method. And that same year, I was learning about feminist politics, and I also came out as a lesbian. So the following year, I took a Canadian social history class, and we had to do a major research project. So I approached the prof and said, I'm really interested in this whole butch and femme lesbian thing, which I was just starting to read about. And I said, do you think I could do an oral history project for this class? And he thought that was a really great idea, and he totally supported it. So that's what I did. So I grabbed my tape recorder and made some connections with people in the community. And actually, it's funny because just the other day I was remembering the very first woman I interviewed scared the bejesus out of me. She kind of sat me down and gave me a good talking to, you know, this is the way it was back in the day. And it's kind of remarkable that I kept doing it because I was a little intimidated, but I guess my first experience had been so good. So I carried on and interviewed some more people, and then I decided to continue pursuing the project as a master's thesis. Actually, I had no intentions of doing that, but my professors encouraged me to, and I guess I'm easily influenced.
So what are then the archives of lesbian oral testimony? When did that start?
Well, what happened is I finished that project in 95, defended my MA thesis, and thought about still doing work on lesbian oral history, but for a lot of reasons decided that I was going to pursue something else for my PhD. So that's done. That's behind me. And that project has really never left me. It's why I became a historian, that project. I love it. And it stayed with me. So I've decided to go back to the project. And I've been working with that material again, doing new interviews, writing new stuff. And it suddenly occurred to me that a lot of us had done these kinds of interviews and hadn't archived any of the material. And I became interested in thinking about this question of what was going to happen to these tapes, because, of course, tapes degrade. You know, right now, oral history is enjoying, I would say, quite a comeback, but it was hugely popular in the 80s and the 90s. And a lot of people were, a lot of people at the community level, but also universities, were producing, you know, creating this data, as they call it in the social sciences, but these incredibly rich interviews, amazing stories. And, you know, had never done anything with them. So I decided to sort of formally look into it. So I got in touch with 14 people across Canada, most who I knew through my contacts over the years, and some who I was told about. All of them had done interviewing of either lesbians or lesbian and gay men. And so I created a kind of survey to ask them, you know, what was your project? What did you do with your stuff? And out of the 14 people, only 3 had archived them. That means that 11 people had produced an incredibly rich set of stories, lesbian stories, that were just sitting there in their basements or attics or wherever. And the trouble with that, of course, is that, as I said, you know, these tapes degrade, and when they're not in the right archival environment, they degrade that much more quickly. I thought, well, you know, here I am at this institution, you know, I teach at Simon Fraser University, and Simon Fraser University, the library, has a quite a substantial oral history collection, not queer, but they also have a very queer positive collection staff, and they approached me when I first came to the university, when I was first hired, and said, you know, if there's queer collections you're interested in, let us know. So I knew that there was a positive environment for me there. I knew that they already had this massive multicultural Canada history, oral history project. And I also knew, and here's the thing, another thing for me, I also knew that they're really committed to open access. You know, a lot of academic material is, in a sense, being privatized, so it's not accessible. You have to pay huge amounts of money to access journal articles and things like that. So there's a movement amongst some scholars to make things open access. And so I knew SFU was committed to that. So I realized that I had access to these resources that I could use to digitize these collections and hopefully put them online in an open access environment so anybody with an internet connection would be able to access them.
That's great. And so I'm surprised, I mean, I didn't take history, but I was surprised that you had an assignment that was to do oral histories. But you were saying this was more popular in the 80s, but now it is making a comeback. So where does kind of academia stand around oral histories right now?
Well, it's not a coincidence that the course in which I did the oral history assignment was a women's history course, because the idea behind women's history is that, and the other histories of oppressed peoples, is that because these people's lives are not well recorded, and the records that we, the archival records that we do have, tend to be from the point of view of those in positions of power, we have to be innovative in finding records. And so oral history became one of those innovative tools, let people tell their own stories. But it was also a political project, very much like consciousness raising, where in telling your story, you would be empowered as the person telling the story. In collecting the story, you would become empowered as the role you play in building community, building a sense of self and strength and value. And by archiving, you create value. And Joan Nessel, who is the person that founded the Lesbian History Archives in New York, which is kind of like Mecca for anybody doing lesbian history, you know, she really understood that, and that's why she created a separate archive just for women, because she knew that in the gay community, it tends to be male-dominated, and unless you have women really paying attention to women's issues, women's needs, it's just going to get overlooked. And that's been the case in other lesbian and gay archives. So that was the idea with this archive, is that, you know, I don't have any, it's not a separatist archive. I'm not a separatist. I don't even identify as lesbian anymore, but there's a need to understand that the way I see it, there was a moment in history in which the term lesbian was a really important identifying category and political category. And for a lot of people, it still is. And I think that's valuable and legitimate and worth knowing about. It's part of our history. So what we're doing in this archive is archiving that political moment, that historical moment. So we don't say this is or is not lesbian. We let narrators and we let researchers make those determinations. If you call yourself a lesbian, we'll put your interview in our collection. If you're a researcher and you defined your project as a lesbian project, we'll put it in the collection. So we're not, we understand that these categories are very fluid and historically changed and historically contested. You know, so we're cool with all of that, but we do understand that lesbian, and it was for me when I came out, lesbian was a very important term and a very important category for me as well. So that's why we're paying special attention to this particular kind of material, because we see that there's a real threat. If we don't do anything about it, this stuff is gone. So the clips that I gave you, Ivy and Lynn, both of those women, they're dead now. They've died. And so keeping those tapes and preserving those tapes is the only record they have of their lives. And I invite your listeners to go to the website and listen to the whole tape. They're not up yet, but they will be eventually. Soon enough, they will be. And they're amazing. They're amazing stories. And it would just, to me, it would just be such an incredible tragedy were we to lose them. And as I say, I'm not, you know, I'm one of the people who's guilty of not archiving them. So I'm in the, I put myself in there with them. And, but there are many, many other stories, like these ones, like those that you're going to play.
What was it like when you were first going out to talk to people? Was it hard to find people that would talk to you, or was it surprisingly easy?
No, it was really hard. And there's a few reasons for it. As I, you know, I've written about, published an article about the, and it's online and anybody can access it, about butch and femme culture in Toronto. And the culture that I look at is people who consider them full-timers in the life. And because surviving in the life meant being absolutely discreet and never telling anybody anything or revealing anything about anybody, because a lot of people were involved in criminal activities. They were stealing, they were breaking into cars and sleeping in them, they were hooking, the prostituting, involved in sex work, or they were involved in drugs, dealing, taking, whatever. And so when you live in that world, one of the rules is shut your mouth and keep your mouth shut. So people don't want to talk. They really don't want to talk, because you just don't talk about it. And I think the other thing, too, is a generational gap. You know, who is this? What did one woman called me? A little tidy. you know, who's this little tidy that wants to come along with her tape recorder and ask about what we did and what does she know about it? So once I built a relationship of trust, it was fine. And as with any oral history project, you meet one person and they tell you, you know, if they like you, then they'll tell their friends. And some of them, not all, some of them will agree to meet with you and talk with you. So it was really, really hard. But it was so worth it. So glad I did it.
What was the most surprising thing you heard?
I think the most surprising thing, stories I heard, were about women who wanted to have children and the lengths they went to have them. So, and these were, well, one was a femme and one was a butch. The woman who was a femme, she survived in the sex trade. And actually, it's Ivy, whose clip you're going to play. She talks about the first time going to the Continental, another bar where there's all these butch broads. And she, at the time, was married, and she had children. And her story was a really tragic story. Her husband beat her up brutally and broke her ribs, and her face was, you couldn't, you know, make out her face. And it was horrible. And she lost custody of her children because he accused her of going to she said they used the phrase lesbian den. She was, you know, understandably really devastated. And it was a straight couple that helped her out through that time. But she got into the party scene and started drinking and became drug addicted and survived in the sex trade. And so when she cleaned up from drugs and decided she wanted to have more children, she had regular tricks. They called them marks. So she had a regular mark, and she said, told him, I want pregnant. And he said, fine. And, you know, he didn't care. So she got pregnant. And as soon as she told him she was pregnant, he disappeared. And she said, that was always a really good way to get rid of a mark. and the other woman was a butch lesbian, and she just could not tolerate the idea of being with a man at all. So she had a lot of lesbians who were sex trade workers, and they really tried to coach her and really tried to help her, and they set the whole trick up and they did everything for her and they stayed with her right to the last minute. And when it came down to it, she just absolutely couldn't do it. And she had a cousin who volunteered to impregnate her. And she thought, okay, well, maybe because I know him, it won't be so bad. And he was really hairy, and she said, oh, I can't stand hair. So he shaved his whole body for her to help her have a baby. So he shaved his whole body to get into bed together. No, she can't do it. So finally, this is the early 1960s, finally she goes to her doctor. So this is in Toronto, and he was black, and that's all I know. I don't know how many black men were doctors in Toronto at this time. I can't imagine very many. But anyways, so she explains to him her dilemma. So he tells her how to use a turkey baster to impregnate herself.
Oh, my goodness.
She does. And she does it. At the time I interviewed her, her daughter was about 19 years old. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, and she was just very happy to have been able to have had this child. It meant a huge deal to her. So those two stories were pretty amazing. They were pretty amazing. I think at the time I interviewed them, I was a single mom myself. And it was very isolating being out in the lesbian community as a mom because I had my daughter when I was 20, so I was very young. So all my friends were, you know, young and out and going to the Rose, which was the bar in Toronto at the time. And, you know, so it was, for me, I think it especially touched me to talk to other women who had children and raised them under difficult circumstances as lesbians. I think that meant a lot to me.
Did any of the women you interview talk about their feelings around the lesbian or queer women's community these days, like the younger women, if they felt happy with the progress that we've made or felt a generational divide or anything like that?
You know, the interviews that I did, they were in the early 90s. So we're talking, you know, now it's 20 years later, right? So it's a huge difference. I know one thing that struck me as funny, you know, some people were still politically active, like Lynn, who I just talked about. She was still politically active. She was working at the 519, and, you know, she was amazing. She loved young people. And so she was still really community connected and very much a part of the queer community. But for women who weren't going downtown, you know, none of these women were going out drinking or anything anymore, right? I mean, those days were over for them. And they lived because, you know, eventually they kept up drinking a lot and their friends died of alcoholism and drug addiction. And those were some, you know, powerfully sad stories too. So, but one story that really, I always thought was really funny was, people would complain about Pride Day and the nudity and the sexual performativity of Pride Day. And they thought it was going too far. And they thought it was obscene and really improper. And I would say to them, well, you know, people used to think that about you in your day, right? You know, dressing up like a little butch and being all tough. People thought that was really obscene, including other lesbians thought that was very obscene too. So I always thought that was really funny. But I think that that's true. I don't think that's unique to lesbians at all. I think that's true to a lot of people who have very fond memories of their day. And they're very emotionally attached to their time. Because, you know, I think our late teens and 20s are so formative. I mean, what happens to you in those years really stays with you, for a lot of us anyways. And so I really understand that. I'll always have special affection for Doc Martens, for example. They're so 90s, you know, and that's when Edie Lang, right? That's my time. So, and they have their time, so.
I was reading something online about a professor who was creating a seminar on lesbian history in the 20th century. I think she was creating the courses back in 2006, but one of the things she was saying is that when she started to order books for her syllabus, she found that virtually every, what she deemed every important work on lesbian history was out of print. So there's just no interest or whatever anymore. Like, I'm wondering if that's something you find and if that's part of why you feel like it's important to make sure lesbian history is included in official historical records.
Well, I can tell you that there's an amazing book that came out just very recently that's a Canadian lesbian history book that's based on oral history. So not every book is, not every important book is out of print. And that one's with UBC Press called Awfully Devoted Women. I don't know if that's true. That may be true. I did think that that was the case, that the lesbian moment had passed and it was over. But one of the really wonderful things for me about doing this, creating this, starting to building this archive, I've been reaching out to the community and going to conferences and giving papers. And it turns out that there's actually a real revival in this kind of work. But of course, what a lot of women are doing, you know, those women from the 50s and 60s are mostly gone now. Well, not all of them, but, you know, there's not as many around. So what they're doing is they're looking at the 70s and 80s. And in fact, at SFU, I've got a student coming, and we're about to launch a major lesbian oral history project of Vancouver's lesbian history in the 70s and 80s. And those women are easy to find. I mean, they're everywhere, and they're wonderful, they're delightful, and they're very well connected, and they're very out. Their lives are really different. So that's going to be a fantastic project, and anybody who wants to get involved in that should get in touch with me, because we're looking for more people to get involved and help us do this. So there's more people doing it. But what's interesting is, you know, when I and other people, when we did our lesbian history projects back in the 80s and 90s, we were lesbians and we were, you know, writing the history of the lesbian past. Whereas now I think people are treating the whole idea of lesbian as a historical thing, you know? So they're thinking about the lesbian past differently. So it's still happening, I would say, and oral history is still happening. But it's happening a little bit differently, as it should, right? No field should stagnate and stay the same. It should develop and evolve and change over time. And we're really excited. We're hoping that our archive can help feed that revival. Because, you know, archives make research possible. You know, those of us who are historians, we don't realize it. We use archives, we rely on them, but we don't always realize how crucial they are to our research. So by creating this digital collection, we're hoping then that we can actually help the field flourish a little bit more.
What about for, like, you know, not academics, but just the public? Like, how do you feel preserving oral history affects maybe social change, like in the present or the future?
Well, I think oral history, you know, as I was saying earlier, oral history was seen as so much a part of the movements of the 60s and 70s. And I think in the more recent history, we've seen how powerful storytelling is with the It Gets Better project. I think that project was so insanely popular because people could be deeply moved in 60 seconds or less, you know? And I think it really showed how powerful life experiences. And I think, though, and here's the real clincher of it for me, is we connect through stories. We connect to each other through stories. You know, I can write now I don't want to offend any of my friends in English or cultural studies, but, you know, we can write a dissection of Radcliffe Hall's Well of Loneliness or, you know, The Children's Hour, the famous lesbian film, and those are really important things to do. But the reason why I fell in love with history is oral history is because when you hear other people tell their own story of the life they lived and are living, it's really effective. You know, it affects me deeply on a kind of human level. And I think it's a very humanizing thing, too. So I think stories are really wonderful and they're really powerful. And they have the ability to transform. You know, there's a historian, Will Roscoe, and when he was writing about gay history back in the, I think, early 80s, he said that oral history saves lives. And that might seem like a really dramatic thing to say, but I think that's what the message was of It Gets Better. You know, it was in response to suicides, and it was trying the idea behind it, and, you know, there's been lots of really good criticism of that project, which I think is fair, but nevertheless, I think the idea behind it is really, really valuable, and it's that, you know, we can help each other, and we do that by telling our stories and relating our experience to each other, and that can make us feel stronger.
How can people get in touch with you if they want to get involved with anything you're doing?
I would love to hear from people who are interested in this project or who are interested in the Vancouver Lesbian Oral History Project. So people can contact me by getting my email address, which they can get from your website. And if you Google me with SFU, you'll quite easily find my homepage at SFU there. Mm-hmm. And my contact information, including my work phone number is there as well. I'd really like to thank the support that I've got from volunteers, volunteer students, volunteers from the community, and from Simon Fraser University in building this archive. It takes a lot of people to pull something like this together, and we continue to do it with the help of all these volunteers, so thanks so much to all of them. And thank you to you for asking me about this project. I really appreciate the opportunity to tell people about it.
Hello, everyone, and big thanks to Elise Chenier for taking the time to talk to me about all of her work. So make sure you check out that website. It's alotarchives.org, and get in touch with her if you want to get involved, especially for those Vancouver-based lesbians. I'm going to play some more of the lesbian archives we're talking about. We're going to hear from, who are we going to hear from? We're going to hear from Lynn. And it's a clip kind of her opinion of what the bar scene was like in Toronto and whether the divisions now within men and women's bar scenes is something that she feels comfortable with or not, or the direction she saw that we were going as kind of a gay community at that moment in time. And also her feelings around the identities surrounding lesbian and gay. So it's really interesting. So that's about 7 minutes. This is the Lesbian Oral History Archives.
So when you did these shows, so what was the club like with the drag queens? Was it mostly male, mostly women, or would you say equal mix?
Almost pretty well 50-50.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty well mixed. And
thinking about how contentious an issue drag queens are today, right? Like a lot of women
They weren't before. They were
stuff.
Very loved.
Like, was it, yeah?
Yeah, like... I'm personally very disappointed in the in certain changes in the gay community.
Yeah.
For me, I don't know. because I'm from the old school, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, I find it real difficult that any gay men's bar or gay women's bar will not let a guy in and drag.
Yeah.
And, you know, and to me, it's hypocritical. It's morally wrong. Like, don't be crying the blues to the straight population about how we want to get equal treatment, equal this, equal that, and then be drawing our own barriers with our own community.
Yeah.
That's, to me, that's dead wrong, you know? And I miss it myself. I love the queens. I mean, sometimes some of them can get on your nerves. Sure they can. But some lesbians can get on my damn nerves,
yeah.
You know? So I don't really like the way we're so distinct with our gay men's bars and gay women's bars. It's I don't like it. I think it's okay if we'd have a couple of gay men's bars and a couple of gay, you know, that are basically exclusive. Because it's kind of nice, yeah, to have your own space and whatever.
Yeah.
But I would prefer if 90% of all gay clubs in Toronto were very mixed.
Yeah.
And we shared our things together more like we used to. You
so
know?
You think it was more shared?
It definitely was.
See, that's... I'm trying to get...
There's a competition. There is some kind of competition now. I feel a competition that we never used to feel.
Well, I think... things are really different, but I just want to try and get at what you're saying, because my sense is that the Continental was like 90% women, at least of the gay people.
Yeah, but
that
was a straight hotel.
Yeah, but
it's just that that
it was like
street type lesbians took over
right
at some point.
Yeah,
that's all that was. Yeah, it was never a gay bar.
No,
ever.
But it was like a claimed lesbian space. Is what I'm saying. Like, lesbians claimed it.
No, well, no, we didn't. Yeah, but there wasn't that attitude. There was no attitude. If guys come in, fine, and they sat with us.
But basically,
they seem to have chose not to go, and I think mostly because they were afraid of the straight guys. They straight men never give lesbians near as much trouble as straight men will give
gay
men ever. And I think, see, because so many of the queens walked around the streets in broad daylight, like they were in drag all the time in those days, right? And I'm really sure some of them were just scared shitless to be at the Continental, because it was a very rough spot, right? It was something that you'd have to have been there and experienced to really, really know how rough that place could be.
Yeah.
And that, right? So
I met a gay man who went to the Continental.
See, because at the very same time that we had our Continental, they had the back of the Parkside. They had the back room of the Parkside long before the first lesbians started to go into the front part of the Parkside. The men had the Parkside before the women started to integrate into the Parkside also, right? So we kind of had, and Charlie's was basically men. But I'm talking more the clubs. These were, see, the, not so much even the bars. The bars, we had the bars, but
yes.
Then we had the clubs, and there was no distinction.
Oh, okay.
See, we'd go,
the women
would go to, say, to the Continental or and was some other places, right? And the men would be here. And at the Parkside, the men were all in the back. It was the men's room in the back, and they'd all be there. And the women would be, and some men would come and sit with us, you know, periodically. We were friends with gay men or whatever, you know. But after bar time, party time at clubs was all completely mixed. There was no, I mean, sure, there would have been some individuals who didn't like faggots, you know, and would make comments maybe, but it was, overall, we just mixed so well. We just mixed very, very well. And it was like, in fact, there was no such thing in any literature, in any signs that were ever put up about anything. It was never, ever lesbian and gay, ever. It was all gay, period.
But lesbians didn't call themselves lesbians then. They called themselves gay, though.
Everybody called themselves gay.
Period. And lesbians didn't start calling themselves lesbians until, like, the 70s, right?
Yeah, I don't even know when it started, you know?
Yeah,
myself.
Well,
I remember when I first realized, I started to see signs, you know, notices about this, that, and that. I said, what? It confused me. I said, how come that sign says lesbian and gay? what do they mean, lesbian and gay? We're all gay. What, you know? And I didn't understand it. And then a younger lesbian was explaining the political part of this, and I got in a real shit mood about it. I didn't like it. I didn't like it myself.
Yeah.
I said, whoa, wait a minute. Why are we doing this? What are we, drawing a line here in our own community? See, it's always bothered me, because I've been on those first marches and everything, and being beaten up by cops and beaten up by men on the street just simply because I was a dyke and stuff, right? And part of fighting for all our rights and everything, and where we did stick together much more, I felt anyway. And to me, the whole lesbian gay thing, just for me, and I may be totally wrong about it, but the way it affected me was, I felt, there's something wrong here. Why are we making these divisions amongst us? You know, why aren't we, you know, we are all gay. I don't give a shit. I'm a lesbian, but I'm gay.
Yeah.
As far as what gay means, I'm gay.
Yeah.
Right? It's not just men that are gay. We're all gay, as far as I'm concerned. And I'm pretty sure just about any older lesbian will tell you that they feel the same way, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They don't understand this distinction.
That was a clip of Lynn talking to one of the participants of the Archives of Lesbian Oral Testimony, found at alotarchives.org, talking about identities and how much things change. That's very true.
The last clip I'm going to play you is another one by Lynn, again off of the Archives of Lesbian Oral Testimony, and this one is just about 3 minutes long, and she's talking about her experience and her observations about the prostitution industry within the lesbian community during her time. So this is Lynn.
I was scared of disease. I was scared, like I say, of getting some maniac, you know. Because I always thought in the back of my mind, why do these men want to go out with dykes? What is this? Why do they want to go out with dykes? And I used to think, you're going to get somebody that's crazy, and they hate queers.
Did some of them, because I know a lot of straight hookers hung out at the Continental,
mm-hmm.
did they go there just because there were hookers there, or did some of them actually go for the ones who they knew were lesbians?
Well, a lot of the lesbians were hookers.
Yeah, exactly. But
yeah.
You're saying like you were wondering why they went out with dykes. Well, I'm thinking, well, they went to the Continental in that area because there just were a lot of
I think a lot of the tricks, and maybe to this day I still don't, unless I don't know if it's some kind of challenge to these men or what it was. But quite often you'd have a feminine person sitting beside a dyke, and the femme going crazy trying to grab a trick, and really pretty.
Yeah.
And everything, cracking all, no, and the guy's looking at the dyke. You want to go, right? And some of the butches, believe me, they were better at the business than some of the femmes. Like Lisa, for instance.
Yeah.
She had steadies, you know, regular steady tricks for years in that. And it was nothing for her to go out in one night and turn 8 tricks.
Do you think maybe the men who went out with butches were sort of... closet homosexuals or something? Like they were attracted to them because they were boyish looking?
I don't think so at all. No. My personal feeling is no. They were totally heterosexual. I don't think they were having any trouble, you know, with their own sexuality.
Yeah. It's bizarre, right?
Yeah, I don't think so.
You know what I
mean? Maybe just a bit of some kind of a curiosity and a bit of a challenge. I'm sure a number of them would have said, buddies, they think they're men. Because that's, they always just say that we think we're men just because we dress the way we did.
Right.
We didn't think we were men. We knew what we were. We were dykes. There's a difference between a dyke and a man.
Yeah.
Right? But they couldn't grasp that. So I think for some of them it was like, to be able to just to say to their buddies, I had that one, right? Do you know what I mean? Because dykes...
Yeah.
I suppose dykes were supposed to hate men and not like sex with men.
Yeah.
Another thing they didn't understand, hookers, 98% of hookers can't stand sex with men.
Yeah.
They can't, even the straight ones.
Yeah.
I mean, it's you're there for the money and that's it. It's like a job, it's something, you know. And that's it and that's all. There's not, guys, Trix, to this day, I don't think Trix really get it. No. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They really don't get it. And they can't help it. They're male. Really, they can't help. But see, and I always had this fear in my mind, though, that maybe some of the reason with some of them is because they were crazy and they hated us. You know? And I don't know. I was always scared of being thrown murder in some room.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the F Word today. I'm Ellie Gordon Marshall, and on the show we had an interview with Li Xinye from alotarchives.org. That is the Archives of Lesbian Oral Testimony.